from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks for tuning in, Johnny. It's Wednesday, the 31st of August, and this is Game On. Coming up on the show, it's a big night in the Premier League. Stephen Kelly joins us to look ahead to the games. Lisa Fallon will also look ahead to Ireland's crucial game against Finland tomorrow. There are big shots in the US Tennis Open early rounds. Stephen Higgins will wrap it all up, plus Declan Quigley on the Vuelta. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Yeah, welcome along, starting with some news today. The experienced Republic of Ireland defender Niamh is out of Thursday night's crucial World Cup qualifier against Finland at Tala Stadium due to a groin injury. Vera Pauw was speaking to the media today and she confirmed that Fahey will not be fit for tomorrow's sold-out clash, but she is hopeful that she might make the trip to Slovakia as she hasn't ruled her out just yet, and she would be an absolutely huge loss tomorrow night. Such an experienced player as well. Ireland can seal a place in the playoffs if they beat Finland tomorrow, but Fahey's absence will no doubt be a massive, massive blow. She does have a good squad, Vera Pauw, though, so hopefully she will have some adequate replacements to step into the role, fill the void, but it is her leadership more than anything that will be missed for sure. There is lots going on in the world of football. It is transfer deadline day tomorrow, so movement is really starting to pick up. The big signing of the day is Wesley Fofana. He has completed his £75 million move to Chelsea from Leicester City. He has signed a 7-year contract, a really long one there. Chelsea are definitely on the hunt for some new players. They have continued to be linked with Pierre Aubameyang, who is set to be sidelined for 3 weeks, having sustained a fractured jaw during an aggravated burglary on his home over the weekend. Manchester United are still waiting for clearance in order to complete the 100 million transfer of Antony from Ajax. Cristiano Ronaldo is also under the microscope at the moment, and it is expected that he is going to remain at Old Trafford for now, with the transfer window, as I said, closing tomorrow. A Republic of Ireland striker, Callum Robinson, could be on the move. He did not feature for West Brom against Wigan in the Championship last night and has been linked with a number of clubs, including Cardiff, Bristol City and Burnley, all who are believed to be interested in Robinson. There are lots of games tonight in the Premier League. Arsenal are at home to Aston Villa, Bournemouth host Wolves, Man City are at home to Nottingham Forest, West Ham face Spurs, and at Anfield then it is the meeting of Liverpool and Newcastle. We'll be talking through all of that football and also the consequences of Nifahi's absence with Stephen Kelly and Lisa Fallon a little bit later on. But we are going to start with tennis. The US Open is in full flight, and Stephen Higgins of Cross Court View is with me here in studio. Stephen, it is one of those days, the early days, when the big names fall, and usually it's one or two, but there seem to be a few now that aren't going to feature from here on in.
Yeah, it was a day of carnage. The
That's
Monday,
a good way of putting it.
I mean, there was, of course, we can get to Emma Raducanu, but I was really surprised at a particular number of exits. Simona Halep, the former world number one, who's been in superb form, made the semifinals at Wimbledon, won Toronto in the build-up to the US Open, crashed out in the first round to 20-year-old Ukrainian Darius Niger, 124 in the world. Then you have people like Stefana Tsitsipas, the world number five, again in good form, did well in Cincinnati, went out in the first round to Daniel Galan, who's number 94 in the world. Tsitsipas has some sort of issue with the back end of the season. He has never made the quarterfinals of either Wimbledon or the US Open, despite doing extremely well at the Australian Open and the French. And then there's more like Daria Kazakina, who's been in great form, top 10 player, won two titles just this month, and then went out in the first round. Roberto Bautista Agut. Naomi Osaka, not that big a shock. Obviously, she hasn't played that much. And she's playing against Danielle Collins, who's a super player. I don't know if you want to get to Emma Raducanu at this point.
Well, you know what? We'll park that and we'll get to it a little bit later on, because there is a lot to get through from those couple of days in the US Open. Stay with us though, Stephen. We're going to switch our attention to football now, and we'll come back to tennis a little bit later on in the show. Stephen Kelly is with me now on the line. Stephen, the day before transfer deadline day, have you ever been caught up in a transfer saga?
I went on deadline day to Stoke from Birmingham literally last minute. It actually was that delayed. My registration didn't go through until just after the window was closed. We got away on account of heavy snow. I've got quotation marks up here. But it was really, really late in the day.
Is it stressful?
Yeah, it is stressful because you're kind of thinking nothing. Like, I wasn't expecting anything to happen. I was at Birmingham. I'd just come back from an injury. So I wasn't expecting something to go through, and then got a phone call last minute. Stoke were in the Premier League and it was their fourth season, and they wanted me to come. I was happy just to kind of get back playing. And it was just, okay, what do we do? Go for it. Yeah, okay, let's drive up for a medical. And it was only a loan move, but it was a bit stressful, all right, you know, because you're kind of just expected to go back to your club the next day and then it all changes. Mm-hmm.
And how much of the decision comes from you, and how much from the agent, and how much from the clubs?
The decision, it always comes down to you at the end. Like, you're the one that has to make it or not. Like, the club can try and force people's hand, or they can try and, you know, tell someone they're not going. But, you know, if both clubs are in agreement on the fee, then the decision's down to you at the end of the day if you want to do it or not. For me, in that instance, it was back playing Premier League football. So it was a no-brainer, really, in Stoke. We're just promoted, so it was an opportunity to go to play, you know, the style of football at Stoke. Probably not exactly what I wanted to be involved in, but it was just one of those things. That was a chance to play in the Premier League again after being injured for a little while, so it made sense to me. And but like I said, if clubs have made an agreement, mm-hmm. it generally comes down to the player's decision whether he wants to go or not. And like I said, there's loads of cases where clubs are trying to force players out. There's loads of cases where they don't want a player to go, but you know, I think that if the final decision usually rests with the players when the clubs have an agreement.
Yeah, the Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang one is an interesting one from that point of view, because it seems like they have agreed personal terms, but it's still dragging on, and you can tell from him that he wants to go to Chelsea. He wants to be back in the Premier League. Obviously, he's had that horrible incident in his home over the last couple of days and has suffered a fractured jaw and will be sidelined. But you would think, just given the amount of talk in the media, that he's going to get there eventually, and given his capabilities when he's on it at Arsenal, he's such a good player and he can make a difference in a club.
No, listen, I've seen him live on numerous occasions, and he's a fantastic striker when he's at it. Like, he really is. His movement's brilliant. Yeah. His finishing is excellent. You watch the documentary Arsenal, and you kind of, you know, Arsenal, we're in, look at Arsenal now, the position they're in, and to have a player like that around your club is not always great, because he can be a bad influence on those younger players. And that's what Arsenal had. Arsenal were staggered with young players that needed someone with the right mindset and attitude to be bringing them forward, and he just didn't display that. Like, you know, you want role models and leaders, and, you know, even though he can do on the pitch, sometimes off the pitch is just as important. But at Chelsea, it's a bit different. He's gone up to the team. They know he can score goals, and that's what Chelsea are lacking. Chelsea are lacking a goal scorer, someone down the middle that can put the ball in the back of the net. So he would probably fit into them. It's just what sort of attitude he comes with.
It's quite an interesting one, the attitude side of the player. And he's so flashy. We all know that. We've seen the cars and the hairstyles and the celebrations. He's that type of person. But is there nobody in a big club like Arsenal, and look, it hasn't worked out for him too well in Barca either, that can sit down and have a chat with him and get him to act in the way that you'd expect a professional footballer to act in an environment that is supremely professional and a results-based business?
Yeah, you're going to have, you know, like, Arsenal's probably different. You probably think the people that spring to mind is someone like Xhaka, that's professional, and I know he's had his bad days at Arsenal as well throughout his years, just based on it. But I don't think it was a lack of doing things right or correctly on off the pitch for Xhaka. It was more just sometimes they weren't happy with his performance levels, even though I think he always played well, and with Switzerland he seems like a consummate pro. So you would have felt that was the player that would have maybe pulled Aubameyang to the side and had a discussion with him. I said, listen, you need to book up and get back on track here. We've got a young side here and we need to be the role models. But, and then it's down to the manager. It has to be the manager. But the manager obviously felt that no matter what he said, no matter what he did, he wasn't getting through to him. So the next best thing is get rid of him. Mm-hmm. Because if you're not going to take on board what the manager's doing, then there's no point in having him around there. And Arteta, it was a really big decision. Highest paid player at the club, big name. It was a similar situation with Ozil as well. And Arsenal have had a bit of a track record of giving players astronomical deals and then turning out not to do what they want them to do. But, you know, it seems to be they were able to get rid of him a bit quicker. And you would think Tuchel coming in, I don't think Tuchel's a man to be trifled with when it comes to behaviours. And, you know, he looks like he had a fallout with Lukaku. He was shipped out. He seems to have the backing of the board for a little while longer, at least. And, you know, the old Chelsea regime, he probably would have been under some serious scrutiny at the moment. But I think he probably has a little bit longer with the new owner. So, yeah, Aubameyang could come in and do well for them. But like I said, it's down to him performing on the pitch and the manager getting the best out of him.
Yeah, interesting times ahead if he does make that move, because as you said, he's such a big player and there'll be so much focus on him. Fofana going to Chelsea from Leicester on a 7-year contract. When you hear 7-year contracts as somebody who has been involved in contract negotiations before, what are your thoughts?
It just seems crazy that it's that long, but I suppose he's 21 years of age and Chelsea like to hold on to their players for as long as they can, even if they're not playing for them. Fofana, I presume, is going to come in and start straight away defensively. They've been really poor and they've kind of put all their eggs in the basket of him coming in and fixing that. The age is fantastic. I've seen him live again a couple of times this season and he's been very, very good. He looks like he had a few injuries early on, but I think he could be fantastic for them. Absolutely brilliant. And with someone beside him like Thiago Silva, who is, you know, getting on in age, but the wealth of experience he can pass on to this young player, it's not a bad partnership, I think, going forward. So for Chelsea, this was the right thing to get done. It was just I don't think they were ever letting go on it. Leicester knew that. They just were digging their heels in to get the most they possibly could out of it. But 7 years. Now in football for a 21-year-old, that's their investment. They want to keep hold of him, and someone wants to come in, they know they're going to have to pay big money for Chelsea to even draw him away from them again.
So let's move on to tonight's games, and we've already seen Scott Parker become the first Premier League manager of the season to depart, so that probably takes a tiny bit of pressure off Steven Gerrard, but he does have to go and face Arsenal tonight, and probably not the fixture that he needs given the pressure that he's under.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a tough match. Arsenal are playing really well. They're top of the league, 4 wins. They're scoring goals, they're being creative, they're inventive, the confidence in the group seems really high. You know, the manager is being loved at the moment, so to go there is going to be a very difficult place. And Villa, who are just not in great shakes, they're underperformed defensively, they look like they're weak. Attack wise, they don't seem to have what they want, and there seems to be a bit of internal stuff going on there with Mings, the captaincy be taken away, and more going on behind the scenes than what we actually know. But yeah, you'd say under pressure, but I don't know, you'd feel, you look at Scott Parker, but I think Gerrard might have a little bit more longevity than what Parker would have. I think just because Parker is now going to be probably labelled with a manager that can get teams promoted, but can't do it in the Premier League. And I think it's a shame, because I think he's got great ideas as a coach.
It's so hard, isn't it? Like, it's just so cutthroat. 9-0 defeat is obviously... it's obviously massive, but like, we're so early in the season, and you know, given now that he has fallen, like, what's the standard now? Like, how many games can Villa lose before Gerrard becomes next? Like, I'd love to know, like, is there a ceiling? Like, is there a cut-off point? Like, how do they even make these decisions?
Nine and loss. Yeah, anything over 4 or 5 loss, they'd probably be in a position where you're going to be getting serious pressure. But I think the fact now that someone's pulled the trigger, it's almost like a free-for-all, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a domino effect. You kind of think that, okay, they've done it for us, so we don't look as bad as them.
Yeah.
We can't do it now ourselves. So it's and that we're joking and laughing about, but it's not nice to be a manager to feel that scrutiny and that pressure consistently. And you are just 1 win away or 1 loss away from losing your job at football, and that's the nature of the game. It's, you know, it is a long season, but for some reason teams seem to make decisions really early on or really rash, and it's whether or not they feel like for some sense there seemed to be stuff going on with Park as well. There was certain comments were said and just different conversations off behind the scenes where you feel like it wasn't going well there. Mm-hmm. And maybe that was more of an issue because him and the board just weren't getting on well. There wasn't a cohesion with the way they were looking to get the team forward. But I think Gerrard will have a little bit more say in pulling power at Villa. The fact he's been able to attract players like Coutinho and stuff like that was purely down to him. I think Villa are going to probably hold on for a little bit longer.
Yeah, he seems to have a bit more gravitas, I think. But it's starting to erode with every passing week. Liverpool, Newcastle... I was thinking this is going to be a really good game and looking forward to it, but it's been reported now just online that Alan Saint-Maximin is out and seems to have injured his hamstring. It's not confirmed now, it's just been reported in different online sources. Who to lose him now for such a big game would be just be a pity for the tie, really.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? When you see his name be linked, you think, please don't let me see Maximin. I want actually this to be an enjoyable game. Yeah. Just let him be there, even for Liverpool fans. And when you see Liverpool, Newcastle, and the way Newcastle are at the moment, you just think those 4-3 games, don't you? That's what I think everybody was thinking. Maybe it could be one of those. But yeah, with Saint Maximin off the pitch, he's such a threat. He's got a great goal the weekend, volley as well. And you know, he gets a lot of criticism about not performing week in, week out, but on his day he's just so electric, he's so hard to play against, and he just frightens teams. So you know, even if when he's not performing well, he still draws two or three men towards him because they're afraid he's going to do something, and that just creates opportunities for the other players. And what Newcastle have done now is they've got a bit more strength in their squad and players of quality in different areas, so when he is attracting players to him, then they get free, and it makes such a difference to them. But he will be a big loss, and a big loss for the tie for a neutral watching if he's not going to be playing.
Yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on that throughout the hour as teams start to come through to us. Liverpool, a 9-0 win, I mean, there's nothing negative you can say about that, but the one thing you'd be looking for them now is just consistency, because, you know, it was such a poor start and it felt like they were building, and then there was the Man United performance and obviously the kickback after that, but they need to kick on now and put another really good performance in place tonight. Do you think they're going to do it?
I think they will put a performance in. I think they're going to be confident after that result. I know it was 9-0, it's very hard, I'm not going to criticise the performance, but before that game I was just not worried for Liverpool, but I just felt they were lacking something. There were the midfield areas, and the manager's come out and said, and I think you and I had discussion before, a couple of times about this, and I said, I just think midfield, they look light, they don't look like they've got what it takes to compete with the top teams in that middle of the park area. You know, Henderson and Milner are unbelievable servants and can still do it, but I think they need people in there around them to be able to help them to do their job. And I think with Thiago, his injury record's not great, so he's going to be in there, even though he's a sensational footballer. You're just not reliable when it comes to playing week in, week out. So I just felt that was an area that needed to be strengthened. And without them, even without the results they've had, I think that was an area that needed to be strengthened. I know they were, Mane was the big subject that they had to go and replace him and the centre forward. But I always felt that the middle of the park was somewhere that they needed to kind of address. And they haven't done that. So, and it's not like Liverpool, because they tend to know what the positions they need and the scouting department and their ability to go and just get what they want and what they need has been very good over the last few seasons. So I expect it to be a really, really good game, but you know, Liverpool probably to come out top being a home at Anfield, and the fans would be a little bit more happy after the big result last week.
Yeah, it's been a really good start to the season, and one of the reasons is because of Haaland in Manchester City as well, and how he's been performing, and just the result of how the players are reacting around him as well against Nottingham Forest tonight. I know that you know, it's been said from the start that he's not going to play every game, that they're going to rest him and manage him as well. But for somebody like him against Nottingham Forest, you'd think that he could probably do wreck.
Oh, I think he could get another hat-trick tonight. Honestly, I think defensively Forest have looked weak. Some of the goals they've given away have been really suspect, just bad position and play and lack of concentration. And I think in the games they've got results and they've worked really hard and they've dug in, but I felt the West Ham game when they played Forest, West Ham hit the bar, hit the post. They should have been clear winners in that game, and Forest clung on, and Henderson pulled off some great saves, and he seems to be the guy that's at the helm of everything. And so if your goalkeeper is making the headlines every week because of his performances, then you kind of feel like you're going to struggle, because at some point there's going to be teams that are not going to, when they're taking shots and get opportunities, the goalkeeper won't even have a chance to save them because they're going to be that good. And that's what City do. that's what City will create so many chances that regardless how well your goalkeeper plays, that they'll put it past them. So I think Haaland could absolutely cause havoc in this game tonight.
Yeah, and I think it might have been you that said it as well, like even when they go behind, like there's no worry, you just think, right, it's only a matter of time now, they're still creating chances, they're eventually going to break the deadlock and kind of take it from there. And that seems to be what they're doing all the time, just sticking to the process, so composed, know exactly what they're doing and know exactly what they're capable of as well.
Yeah, I think that's what's been almost as impressive as anything else they've done is they've gone behind, but they've the reaction to get back into the game is so quick. It's almost like, oh, how dare you score a goal against us? And they just come back out and like white teams aside, it's an amazing attitude and turn of gears that they can just literally flip it and all of a sudden they get back in front within minutes. And the other teams are just reeling because they just don't know what's happened. They're thinking, oh, we're going from being a goal ahead to be 2 or 3 behind. It's a sensational level of performance that they have week in, week out. And I said that the mindset that's in those teams and the belief that's in the players is brilliant. So, yeah, I think City are just, they're such a strong side on their first 11, everybody on the bench. And I think it's going to be just way too much for Forrest.
Yeah, goal fest is probably a good way to describe it. West Ham and Spurs. So there was a few concerns about West Ham. They were their start of the season. They got their monkey off the back over the weekend. Coming up against Spurs, a team that, like traditionally, well, over the last number of years anyway, are someone that they're more often than not able for.
Yeah, I think London derbies for Spurs, I've never, like, we've never been always running away with games. We've never always got the better of the London teams, and West Ham has always been a side that have been able to put up to us for most parts. But I know Tottenham seem a bit more resilient than what they have done over the last few seasons. I think we spoke about before the players they've brought in. Again, they have a squad now that can change and they can adapt. And I think West Ham, yeah, getting that result was really important for them. But again, so it's against a poor Aston Villa. 1-0, so I don't think they're going to be going into this game full of confidence, but they're going to be better than what they were before. And you know, every London derby brings out, you know, the West Ham fans will be in full tilt. It's quite an imposing place when the fans are really on, and especially against Tottenham, they're going to be up for this one. But it makes it for a really good game, because to West Ham, like I said, slightly more confident than what they have been, and Spurs in a really good position. So this is going to be a real test to see if Tottenham can continue on the good form.
Yeah, it's I feel like at the moment, I don't know why, but it feels like every game is a big game at the moment.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just because they're all coming so thick and fast, but there seems like there's a lot of them anyway very early, and we know that the World Cup is looming too, so they feel really, really important. Okay, so Stephen, stay with us, because we are going to turn our attention to Ireland and Finland tomorrow. Lisa Fallon joins us on the line as well. Lisa, all the way back from Costa Rica.
Hi, Marie. Yeah, a little bit of jet lag, I think, kicking in. But yeah, it was an incredible tournament over there for the FIFA Women's Under 20 World Cup. Really phenomenal tournament. Very impressed with the standard, the technical, tactical, physical, mental application of players. Honestly, some really, really exciting players coming through, and obviously, hopefully, some of them will push through to senior level, maybe at next year's World Cup, but certainly in the years coming after that. But really, really impressive, beautiful country, and just lovely to be in somewhere so different and seeing football there, and yeah, an incredible experience, I have to say.
Well, you documented it very well on Instagram anyway, and I'm a big fan of football stadiums, so it was great to see so many. But just one question on the talent coming through from the women's side, Lisa. You know, we know that women's football is still very much in its infancy because of it was banned for so long, and, you know, we're still playing catch-up in the game and, you know, kind of developing women's football around the country. But one thing that we have noticed is over the last major tournaments I've got to see is that the players are getting fitter, faster, stronger. They're getting exposed to better coaching, sports science as well. And you can see all the developments at that top level. Is it coming through as well? Can you see the players at the underage level, at that the young girls coming through, that there is a bigger pool and that they're better players too?
You really can, and that was one of the things we kind of wanted to see was, okay, yes, we're looking at the tactical and the technical trends that are emerging, but we wanted to see, like, what is the application of players to, you know, how are they applying game strategies, how are they able to adjust them, and, like, players were so tactical, the game plans were so well thought out, and you know, you could see exactly what teams were trying to do. Players, you know, some of the players were only 16, 17, so they'll have another 2 years, you know, they'll have another cut at this age group. But the physicality, you're right, the speed the ball was moving, Japan were sensational. I mean, they just moved the ball 1 and 2 touch little triangulated passes through the third, so technical, and you can see the vision they have, the what they want to do, and then they have that technical capacity to execute it. And Spain beat Japan in the final, actually a replay of the 2018 final when Japan won 3-1. Spain reversed that score in this year's final. But even you look at Spain, you know, the quality they have coming through. Inma Gabarro, their centre forward, you know, she is a quality player. The movement that she makes in and around the centre backs, and her anticipation, and getting on the end of crosses. She finished up the golden boot, the top scorer. But you know, these are clever game intelligent players, and interesting as well that, you know, we started to see like different things, like more shots from outside the box. You know, players have better technique, but also they're playing against better organized lower defenses as well. So it was just the physical speed and the athleticism of the players has really escalated. And it was interesting because, like I said, this is the first one. It's normally, this competition is normally every 2 years, but this one was the first one since 2018 because of COVID. And, you know, you were wondering, would the COVID gap make a difference? But, you know, generally the whole, you know, the general consensus really was that the standard has gone up quite significantly. And like I said, if this is the standard coming through at under 20 level, you know, it's really, really bodes well for what's coming in the future. I'll be going over to India in next month, in October, for the Women's Under 17 World Cup. So it's going to be really interesting now to see how it's looking from under 17 to under 20. And then obviously next summer, and we're benchmarking, I guess, off what we saw in 2019 and obviously in the Euros this year. But you can see that the women's game is developing massively, and you know, that's down to the professionalism. You know, professional leagues now, it's becoming a full-time career for players, and you really, really are starting to see that, not just at senior level like we did in the Euros, but certainly that is filtering to under 20, and hopefully we'll see it again at under 17 level.
Yeah, sounds great, and just bodes really well for the future as well and what's coming down the track. And the first thing that's coming down the track, Stephen Kelly, is the Women's World Cup next summer, and we are hoping that the Republic of Ireland women's team with Vera Pauw at the helm will be there. They have a crucial game against Finland tomorrow, and if they win that, they will be heading for the playoffs. It looks like it is a very complicated system, so we won't get into it too much, but what I will say is that they need to win tomorrow's game. That is the next thing that they need to do. But they're going to have to do it, Stephen, without Niamh Fahey. She's been ruled out of that game due to a groin injury. Not ruled out of the Slovakia game yet, but tomorrow's one really is the big one. How big of a loss is she going to be?
Yeah, she's huge. Just her experience as well. She's been around for so long. She understands what's needed. And I think her desire to try and help Ireland qualify for a major tournament has got to be so high. She's been through so many close encounters with the female team. It's been all. And she's one of those experienced heads now that you rely on in games like this, and, you know, be disappointed. But she's still around the squad. She can still give nuggets information to the girls. She's so highly thought of within the squad as well. So she's someone that's vital to be around and be part of it, because sometimes that can be the difference. Just having the fact she's actually there helps out, and we'd love to have her on the pitch, but it is going to be a loss. But I think they have to they know that if this is like a cup final, it really is. I know it's been a group stages, but it gets to this one game where it kind of everything's pinned on it, and they know what's at stake. I think they're coming so close to really making the mark, and you know, with the sold out stadium, the fans are going to be behind them, the atmosphere should be fantastic. On the back of what they've seen in the summer with teams that, you know, they're probably better than a lot of teams that were in the Euros, the Irish national team, they would feel like we could compete or be better than some of those teams. So, you know, they're looking at that and feeling they deserve to be in a major tournament, and this is hopefully a stepping stone in the right direction, and they can get the win.
Lisa, what kind of a setup would you prefer to be part of? So Finland are coming off a disappointing Euros, manager woes, and, you know, obviously have someone new in now and going to get that bounce, or, you know, the Ireland, which is really steady and, you know, kind of doesn't have that as much of a point to prove after a disappointing major tournament. Like, who's got the advantage here?
Well, I think Ireland absolutely do, because, you know, it's a settled team. I think we can really see what the identity of the team is now, you know, both in possession and out of possession. You can see exactly what the structures are, what the roles of the players are, and they know these roles and they're becoming competent with them. And I think the away win over in Finland last year really actually gave the players belief, and we saw that belief transfer then to the away game against Sweden. And, you know, this is the best... I think this is the best Irish squad we've ever seen in terms of the, not just the quality in the starting 11, but the level of depth that Vera has available now. She's got options in different positions, and they're quality options. And she's also got players now who can bring different solutions to different types of scenarios. You know, what the different forward players offer. They bring something different, each one of them. And that's really good for us to have. I think it's the first time we've had that level of depth. And, you know, the squad is the best resourced probably than any previous squad. So, you know, they really are in the best position. And, you know, yes, it is a bit of a pressure game, but I think, you know, now is the time that, you know, if you want to compete at the highest level and really be a high performing team and compete against the best teams in the world, you have to be able to go in and inflict your game plan on them and, you know, really take the game to them, but also to start to embrace the favourites tag when you play against teams that are in and around you in the rankings or slightly below. And I think that's just something that Ireland traditionally have struggled with, and that is the key, is that moment of pressure, being able to deal with it. But I think there's a real resilience in this team now, and that comes from hurt, that comes from defeats and disappointments and near misses, and it gets to a point where you're just like, we are not losing this game, or we are winning this game today. And I really feel that the squad is in that place right now, and like you know, you're right that Marco, the under 17 manager from Finland, he's now taken charge since Anna Signal finished up. She was due to finish up, I think, at the end of the year, but they made the decision to make the change for the last two group games. He actually managed the Finland under 17s, I think, when they were in Ireland earlier this year playing the Irish under 17s, and he plays a 4-4-2 quite similar to what Anna Signal played. So yes, look, Ireland might expect a couple of little different things from Finland. He's certainly probably changed the age profile of the squad. He's brought in the three midfielders from Coops, and the three of them are actually really high flying at the moment. Linda Sahlström, I think, is potentially the eldest in the squad and the goalkeeper. But you know, there's a little bit of uncertainty with Finland, but I think Ireland are just settled now. They're very composed. They know what they've to do. They've embraced, I suppose, the pressure. And look, they've been in this situation before, and you would like to think from the Ukraine game, in that all-important Ukraine game, and the Greece away game in the last campaign, I really get the feeling that the players have learned from that experience, and that type of experience really does stand to you. And I think having a big sellout crowd in Tallaght will be massive for the players as well, because, you know, there will be setbacks and challenges, etc., in this game. But I think look, the players are probably going to have to go to the well in this game to get there, because it's not going to be an easy game. Finland do have a lot of quality, and they wouldn't have qualified fight for the Euros had they not got the quality that they do have. But, you know, we know that they're a fast counter-attacking team, so Ireland just need to be well structured underneath the ball, make sure that everybody has their roles and just does their job. And I think if Ireland get the performance right tomorrow night, I think Ireland, you know, I'm confident that Ireland will win. And certainly, if you're either of the two managers going into this game, you would want to be in Vera's shoes, for me, I think, for sure.
Yeah, but you know, when a team has a new manager in and there's that bounce, it's always a little bit of a worry. But still, I don't think it's going to be lost on anyone in Tallaght, from any of the teams or anyone in the crowd either, how big a game it's going to be for everyone. One thing, though, Stephen, that maybe we didn't have before is the quality of player playing at such a level, right across the pitch. But it is led by Katie McCabe, and to have a world-class player, you know, it's not something I think that we really appreciate, because we don't see enough of Katie. We see some of the Women's Super League, but, you know, the teams that she's playing, the level that she's playing at, the respect that she gets from her peers, it doesn't, I don't think, translate as much here, but like, she's such a big deal in women's football. And, you know, we have her and Denise O'Sullivan too. So to have two players and two players that are combining really well as well when it comes to goals and assists, it's such a boost.
Yeah, it's huge. You know, I was lucky enough to play in Irish teams that we had a few superstars and Duffer and Robbie. And, you know, you know going into games that we can stay in matches and there's a chance that one of those players can come up with something for you. You know we're all Premier League players, but to have actually bona fide superstars that are score 100 goals in the league or that sign for and win Premier Leagues with teams, you know, does make a difference. So for me, for the women's team now, having Katie in that side, and you know, all you have to do is every time you see her name comes up, it's usually because it's some absolute worldly goal she scored. That's every on your Twitter feed or on your Instagram. That's what pops up for her. It's always an amazing goal or amazing tackle. She doesn't do things in half measures, you can see she's got a self belief and a drive within her, which is amazing. And that feeds into the players as well. So to have players like that in your side that can, you know, in a moment of need or a moment when you need someone to stand up, that gives you confidence in the group that these players can do it, because they do it so regularly for their club that when it comes to the international level, it's just become second nature to them, and they don't shrink when it comes to those challenges. They go in with the head first. And like I said, I was very lucky to play with players that did that in abundance with club and country. So you know to have something like that is really special, and I think the fans get on board and get behind them as well. And like I said, the level that she's playing at week in, week out, and look, half her teammates won the Euros with Arsenal, like the captain and stuff. So you kind of feel like she's held in such high esteem over there as well. It can only benefit us that we have players like that in the squad.
Okay, it is an absolutely huge game, and it will be live here on Game On tomorrow evening. We'll have live commentary plus panel and analysis all after our usual Game On show, so do please tune in for that. Lisa and Stephen, thank you so much. And just very quickly, are you confident, Stephen?
Yeah, I am confident. I am.
Lisa?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is their time.
Great. Okay, guys, thanks so much. We're going to take a very quick break now, though. We have plenty to come at the Vuelta, and we'll be going back to our tennis.
Game On 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. We are turning our attention now to tennis. It is day three of the US Open, and the stars are falling as the days go on. Let's start with Emma Raducanu. Stephen Higgins of Cross Court View is with me here. Stephen, I don't think there were high hopes for her going into the tournament, even though she was defending champion. And it was more so what she was saying rather than anything else. She herself didn't seem to be overly confident. And after losing in the first round, she said herself that she's actually looking forward to starting with a clean slate. She said she's disappointed, but in a way, the target will be off her back and she's going to just try and claw her way back up to the top.
Yeah, I guess she couldn't say anything else. It must be disheartening to look at the ranking list. With Emma Raducanu, you win 2,000 ranking points if you win a Grand Slam. She actually won another 40 points because she got through qualifying. 2,040 points drop from her ranking because of that loss, which means that she goes from number 11 in the world down to 80 in the world next or after the tournament. Yeah, I mean, it is a reset. I watched this last night, and you know, it's very interesting when the British commentators oscillate back and forth between loads of comments beforehand that she's got this, she can do this, to a few games in when Lise Korn, a notable giant killer who stopped Iga Swiatek's unbeaten record at Wimbledon, started playing like Lise Korn, took advantage of an obviously nervous Emma Raducanu, and then, you know, the wheels kind of came off basically. And I felt sorry for. We don't really even know what the level of Emma Raducanu is. We won't know that for a few years. Maybe it's a golden fortnight that she had. Maybe it's just a building block and she'll win future Grand Slams.
Sometimes footballers make their debut and they're absolutely brilliant and then they never play well again. Like, it happens.
Yeah, I mean, she'd also follow in the line of, say, Yelena Ostapenko, who, while she's had a good career since and done some things, she never really has reached the level that she did in the fortnight when she won Roland Garros. Bianca Andreescu, mainly through injuries, hasn't hit that level either. There have been, on the women's side, some young players who've broken through who haven't quite fulfilled maybe that potential or that ability afterwards. We'll have to see.
What would it be, though? What would it take? What do you need to win to fulfill your potential?
Well, I suppose that's a debatable thing of what someone's potential is. I guess when she won the US Open last year, everything was brilliant. Mm. So all aspects of her game looked great, particularly her returns, her movement, her composure, her forehand, her backhand, etc. This time over the last year, you've seen more of the issues of her forehand isn't quite as good. She makes maybe some rash decisions. She got quite erratic against Cornet. Cornet was brilliant last night. Cornet's had a superb season. Her best year on tour, age 32, when she was contemplating retirement. And she just took full advantage of the lack of confidence and questioning of Raducanu's game, basically. So she just wanted to get her into long rallies.
She used her experience.
Yeah, she exposed the situation or took advantage of the situation, and the match went kind of as probably everyone expected.
So she's gone. Elena Rybakina, who won Wimbledon, is also gone as well in the first round.
Yeah, the Wimbledon champion, but not quite, as she might put it. She spoke recently before the tournament that because Wimbledon had the ban on Russian and Belarusian players, the ATP and WTA responded by removing the ranking points. So despite her breakthrough, she did not receive the 2,000 ranking points that she would have got. If she had got those ranking points, she would have moved up to about 6 in the world. She didn't get them. She's around 25 in the world, which has a big effect on, you know, your placement, obviously, of seedings and also marketability and sponsorship. Mm-hmm. So she criticized this beforehand, and she seems to, yeah, she hasn't kicked on, I suppose would be the way to put it, from the tournament so far.
And what about Naomi Osaka? What's our expectation of her now?
It's very hard to tell. You know, she's really struggled since she's kind of come back to playing in recent months after her break. It really seems to be up to her. We know her class. She won 4 Grand Slams. At her best, she's a superb player. How interested is she in putting in the effort to compete with the best female players? It's really up to her. There's no question of the ability of what she can do at her best. It's really just, does she want that as much, or is she more interested in other things?
4 Grand Slams is a lot.
It is. I mean, she's so exciting. At her peak, she's such a fantastic player to watch at her peak. In some ways, it's sad. You know, it's her life. She makes her own decisions. But she was so fantastic to watch, such a brilliant character on the tour. You'd love to see her kind of come back and give another go for a few years, and like, we'll see what she can do again.
So Simona Halep is also gone. So she crashed out in the first round to 20-year-old Ukrainian Daria Signor.
Yeah, I mean, Daria Signor is, she won Wimbledon as a junior in 2019. Oh no, this is a massive shock. This is probably the biggest shock of the
There's
tournament.
A lot of shocks here now,
yeah,
in the last few days.
Halep has been world number one, but actually she was playing really well coming in. She made the semifinals of Wimbledon. She won the tournament beforehand in Toronto. And to go out in the first round to the world number 124 is terrible really for her. You know, she'd be massively disappointed.
Yeah. So who's left then for us to look at, and who's your favourite?
Well, in the men's or the women's?
In the women's. Let's start. Keep with the women's.
Yeah, in the women's, it's very open, as it often is. You know, Serena's still involved. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Serena's playing tonight against Annette Kontaveit. Kontaveit is the world number two, but she has struggled with actually COVID this year, and she's only kind of coming back into fitness. It'll be interesting to see what level Serena can kind of hit. At this point, that'll be at midnight if people want to tune in, if they're not getting up too early in the morning. I don't know, for the women's, Iga Świątek is still involved. After her unbelievable start to the season, the wheels came a little bit off in the last few months, where she's had a few losses. She had a great start, won 6-3, 6-love in her opening round. It'll be interesting to see if she can kind of rediscover the form of early season when she was literally unbeatable. So she will be the one to kind of watch, but as is often the case with the women's draw, because it's best of three sets, I can give you a list of five names. They'll all get knocked out in the next 2 days, and then I'll look like an idiot. So Świątek is the player to beat still, because she's the world number one and she's kind of found a bit of form again. But anything can happen. Oh, there's one or two I might just mention quickly. Beatriz Haddad-Maia, a Brazilian who's playing really well lately and on a great run. And Caroline Garcia, one of my favourite players for years, is in the best form of her life and has won a couple of tournaments recently. They're just ones kind of beyond the usual names.
And then in the men's, Nadal did have a scare, but he's came through that.
Yeah, in the men's, it's a pretty kind of straightforward thing. The top two seeds are Daniil Medvedev, the defending champion, and Rafael Nadal. They are set to meet in the final if it follows the seeding. Actually, if they played in the final, the winner will become world number one. So that'll be on the line. Daniil Medvedev has a really good run through to the final. the big thing to watch would be there's a potential fourth round clash with Nick Kyrgios, which would be obviously entertaining in all kinds of reasons. Nadal actually was a bit ropey at the start the other night. He dropped the first set, but then kind of remembered that he was Rafael Nadal and then won three sets at a canter.
He does that a lot.
Yeah, unlike Stefanos Tsitsipas, who I have to say that is so disappointing for a player of his class, number five in the world, went out in the first round to the 94th player in the world. You know, he said he played like an amateur, which I suppose I understand that sentiment. but still, just for his caliber, a shocking loss. Like, you know, it's something that when you compare someone like Nadal, Djokovic, Federer, the difference of they just will not allow themselves to lose in the first round to someone who's 94 in the world, you know, whichever way you spin it.
Okay. Good few days to come. So, Stephen, no doubt we'll be talking to you about it for sure. Lots of drama already, and there should be lots more drama to come too. We're going to take a very quick break. Do stay with us, though, because we'll be talking about the Vuelta.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It is now time to turn our attention to cycling, and I am delighted to say that Declan Quigley joins us on the line. Usually when we talk to you, Declan, you are somewhere exotic. Are you anywhere at the moment?
I certainly am. I'm in the balmy suburb of Dublin called O'Leary.
Oh. So,
it's still sunny.
You had me there for a second. I was sucked in, and I thought you were going to say you were over at the Vuelta or somewhere even further afield. But look, Dunleary on a sunny day is hard to beat for sure. Tough few days for Sam Bennett, going so well in the Vuelta. I'm sure he had hopes of winning the green jersey, but was forced to withdraw due to COVID, which has reared its head again in the Vuelta anyway.
Yeah, it certainly has. I mean, it's almost going to be a bigger club than those two left in the race, the way things are going. 21 riders so far have exited the race as a result of COVID. At least one rider every day since stage 5. Stage 11 today, 5 riders had to call time. Sam was one of 10 that didn't start yesterday, stage 10 time trial. So it's definitely a little bit of an issue. There are certainly COVID protocols in place. I mean, the masks around the finishing areas and, you know, wherever any of race organisations, journalist teams, etc. are involved. But it's a funny old sport, really. I don't think there's a sport on planet Earth, or not too many at any rate, that you can get quite as close to the action as you can in professional cycle racing. And I mean, Sam himself has spoken of the fact that you can almost feel the breath of the fans when you're on those big mountains, and why normally that intimacy is part of the charm of the sport. I suppose in this particular instance, it comes with certain dangers. That's just one element. I mean, they've had a couple of transfers as well. They've been on a couple of planes. They've had a couple of bus rides as well. They've had long waiting areas in tents and things like that. So he doesn't know where he got it, but super frustrating. I mean, he's just getting into a bit of form. It was just coming for him, you know?
Yeah, it really was. And it's quite interesting because, you know, for the last few weeks and months, I've been covering quite a lot of different sports, but it didn't seem to be as prevalent. And, you know, people weren't being ruled out in big numbers. So it's definitely, I'd say, one they're going to have to study and try and figure out. But you made some really good points about the fans and the proximity and the travel and all the rest. But the reality is that, you know, it's been diminished now because so many cyclists are out of it. And how realistic, like, was it for Sam Bennett to come away with the green jersey?
He was in a right old dogfight. It was a one-on-one fight with Mads Pedersen, former world champion. Slightly different approaches, as Sam has said, in that Pedersen can get up in the medium mountain stages, might be able to get into breaks that Sam can't get into, up over some of those hills, with slightly less difficulty than Bennett. But Bennett's a bit quicker, you know. So when it comes to those sprint finishes where it is the big mass gallop and the bunch is all together, then Bennett is more likely to get the win. And he's back, you know, got his mojo back. I mean, it's been a long time coming, hasn't it? I mean, he had that knee injury that ruled him out of Tour de France last year. Never got going again with Quickstep. Came sad and sorry end to that tenure at the end of 21, and then back at Bora this year. Looked like he had the lead out train all sorted, but he couldn't get himself going, and it took a long, long time. Missed the Tour de France, and then suddenly you could see it, couldn't you, at the European Championships, that fifth place finish there, but it was starting to come, and then bang, out of the gates, won the first two stages of the Vuelta, and you know, had a lead, had lost the lead, but was still very much right in it with Pedersen. And when he retired from the race yesterday, there were still 5 sprint opportunities ahead of him, including today's stage. So, I mean, he'll have been very frustrated. Today's stage was won by Caden Groves for a team bike exchange. His teammate, Simon Yates, was sixth overall in the bike race and had to pull out because of COVID today. So that was a bit of a bittersweet day for them. But second in today's stage was Danny Van Poppel from the Warren Hansgrohe squad. Now, he's the lead-out man. He's the final guy that sort of drops him off with 200 metres to go. And Van Poppel has been extraordinary this year. Really, really good. As good as Michael Murko at Quickstep. And, I mean, Bennett will be looking at that now and going, thinking, oh, if I had been dropped off by Danny Van Poppel, it would have been a slam dunk. Of course, it doesn't always work out like that. A moment's hesitation, sort of, make the wrong decision, and it doesn't work out. But he'll certainly be thinking missed opportunities. I think whatever about the green jersey, that would have looked after itself to a certain extent. He would have chased those wins, and I think he had a great opportunity. And of course, he's missed out on that thing that he really wants to do, which is win the final stage of all three Grand Tours. You know, the Champs-Élysées, the final stage of the Giro d'Italia, and the final stage of Vuelta in Madrid. On Sunday week would have been a big one for him, you know.
Oh, that's so frustrating. And you could actually even see just from his tweet a little bit earlier, he said, "I'm feeling fine and I'm looking to the calendar right now to figure out where and when I can race again." So that's obviously what he wants to do, and that's forefront of his mind. So hopefully we'll get back to that very quickly. Just then, the general field, how are things looking? How is it shaping up?
Fascinating, but it always is. You know, it's sort of thought of as the third of the three Grand Tours, the three week races in cycling. But in many ways, it often throws up the most fascinating battles. And what you have at the moment is a situation where you've got a dominant performer, but it's very exciting. It's a 22-year-old Belgian guy, Remco Evenepoel. Another tough name for you to try and pronounce.
I had to do it on the news on Friday, and I must have tried it out about 15 times.
Evenepoel, you just have to pretend you're Flemish for it works easy. But he's an interesting character. He tried his best not to be a cyclist because he was quite a good soccer player. He played for a youth international for Belgium. He was on the books at Anderlecht. Yeah, but his dad had been a pro bike rider, and when he had an injury, as often the case, got on the bike, went junior racing in Belgium, which is the toughest school on planet Earth, and won every single race he entered for a year and a bit, and it was just extraordinary. Turned pro at 18, which again is very rare, although a little bit less rare these days, and won a World Tour race in his first year. He's an absolute tyro. He had a bad crash in Lombardy there the year before last. He has come back, but the smart thinking was that he can't do 3 weeks, that he can't get up the really big 20-minute, half-an-hour mountain. But so far, he's doing all of that. Whether he can get the full 3 weeks remains to be seen. But if he does, he'll become the first Belgian to win a Grand Tour since 1978, I think. First Belgian to win the Vuelta since 77. They win one-day races, classics, all that kind of stuff with gay abandon, but they don't win the Grand Tours. So for Belgium, that would be extraordinary.
Yeah, and we'd have no problem then saying Remco Evenepoel, because he would
Pretty
be
good.
Someone that we will know from now on in. Thank you so much, Declan. Appreciate it. And we will check in with you again very, very soon. We're almost out of time. Stephen Higgins is still with me. Stephen, just before we finish up, another shock in the US Open.
Yeah, the third seed, Maria Sakkari, has just crashed out to the world number 75, Jiu Wang, in three sets. A shame for Greece, as Sakkari joins her compatriot Stefana Tsitsipas in JFK's departure round much earlier than expected.
Right, well, it is all happening in the US Open. We are out of time now. We'll be back tomorrow, though, and we will have live commentary of that crucial World Cup qualifier between Finland and the Republic of Ireland in Tala Stadium. So do join us from 6 p.m. here on 2FM. Tara Kumar is up next. RTE 2FM.